This is Gesher, the podcast that's bridging the gap between the Jewish and evangelical Christian communities with conversations that matter. Here's your host, Ty Perry, with the Friends of Israel Gospel Ministry.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to this episode of Gesher. A few weeks ago, followers of Jesus around the world celebrated Resurrection Day. We read and studied the New Testament account of his trial, death, burial, and resurrection from the grave. And all throughout that narrative are references to one of Judaism's holiest times, Passover. Despite its constant presence in the Gospels, though, most Christians have only a dim understanding of the Holy Day, its development over time, its significance to the Jewish people today. And so I'm hoping today to change that. Joining me to discuss Passover is Rabbi Michelle Fottam. Rabbi Fottam is the rabbi for Hillel of Metro Detroit. An experienced and passionate Jewish educator, she earned her rabbinic ordination and a master's degree in Jewish education from the Jewish Theological Seminary in 1995. Rabbi Fottam teaches numerous classes for J-Learn Adult Education in Detroit, and I'm pleased to have her on the show today to talk with us about Passover. Rabbi, welcome to Gesher.
Thank you for having me, Ty.
Well, Rabbi, I want to begin by talking about the account of Passover, the biblical account itself. I've heard some of my Jewish friends say over the years that you can sum up many Jewish holidays simply by saying, they tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat. And I think that reduces things probably much too far. But I want us to think about that in terms of Passover. It seems like that's not a bad place to start. So let's briefly remind listeners of the background. In fact, we kind of get a preview or a foretelling of it in Genesis 15, where God tells Abram, and I'll just read the account here, "Know certainly that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, and will serve them, and they will afflict them 400 years. And also the nation whom they serve I will judge. Afterward they shall come out with great possessions. Now as for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried at a good old age, but in the fourth generation they shall return here, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete." So that's the setup. That promise is given some four centuries prior to the Exodus. So walk us through the story. How do we go from this childless, nomadic Abram living in Canaan to Egypt in the account there?
That's a tremendous amount of...
No pressure.
Genesis 15 on.
Yeah.
So Abraham has Isaac, right?
Right.
Isaac and Rebekah get married. They have Jacob and Esau. Jacob gets married too. It's a little bit of a story there too. Mm-hmm. We'll skip that. Not with, you know, there's no disrespect there. Jacob has sons. One of those sons is Joseph. Joseph ends up being sold to Egypt. Whether it's by the Ishmaelites or the Midianites is not quite clear in that story. Joseph finds his way down to Egypt and is brought into the house of Mr. Potiphar. Mm. And in that, he has dreams, which we know about, rises up. Pharaoh has a dream, can't be explained. The butler, who is one of the people who was in jail with Joseph, after Mrs. Potiphar accuses Joseph of attempted rape, which is also an interesting story.
Very.
He ends up interpreting Pharaoh's dream, 7 years of plenty, 7 years of famine. And during those 7 years of famine, Joseph's brothers make their way down to Egypt. And Joseph has the foresight at that point to settle them in Goshen, in an area kind of outside of the main area of Egypt. Mm-hmm. He tells Pharaoh that his brothers are shepherds, which is an abhorrent profession in Egypt. And in this way, he settles them away from the rest of the Egyptians. The commentators tell us he had the foresight to be able to keep them in their own place so they would inmarry.
Mm.
There's a whole back and forth there. There's a great story. I'm sure many of the listeners know it. Eventually, Jacob comes down to Egypt. Jacob is brought down to Egypt. And at the end of Genesis, we already see that the Israelites are kind of settling in, and they really weren't supposed to. It was supposed to be a temporary peace.
And growing too, as a people.
They were growing as a people, but we don't see the tremendous growth. We see the tremendous growth happening at the beginning of Exodus, mm-hmm. with the verbs that are used when the new Pharaoh comes along, who didn't know Joseph, didn't know the history. And he talks about how he, politically, it was so brilliant. You know, he kind of is playing to his, to the different constituents, saying, okay, we've got this group here that is multiplying. And he uses a couple of verbs to talk about how they multiply. So in, whenever we're reading Torah, whenever we're reading the five books, we have to look very clearly at the words. Why are there extra words in the Torah? Mm-hmm. There are no extra words in the Torah. Each one has to be interpreted for what it brings. It has to bring something new.
Yeah.
So the very fact that they were that in the book of Exodus, at the beginning of Exodus, it talks about how they multiplied. It uses more than one word to describe how they multiplied, tells us that they multiplied tremendously. Mm. So we get a new king who comes along, is nervous about the Jews and their growth. He's afraid they're going to take over, and they begin to enslave the Israelites. And you know that lasts, and we have Moses who's born and gets raised in one of the things that Pharaoh says is we don't want any male children. We need to kill all the male children. So Miriam, Moses's sister, is smart enough to know she's got to save this baby. She puts him in a basket, sends him down the aisle. Lo and behold, Pharaoh's daughter sees the basket, recognizes it as a Jewish baby, maybe because of the clothing already. Mm-hmm. Obviously, she would have recognized it from a circumcision if she had opened up the diaper, but right. You can already see even before she gets her hands on him, she sees that it's a Jewish baby, so there must have been something in the dress.
Yeah.
That indicated that it was that he was a Jewish baby. He grows up in the house of Pharaoh, but he knows that he's not of one with Pharaoh. And we've got this story of he sees an Israelite being beaten by an Egyptian. He kills the Egyptian, buries him in the sand. The wording there is also very interesting. And then the next day he sees two Israelites fighting. He says to them, "Come on, guys, why are you fighting?" One of them says, "Are you going to kill us like the Egyptian?" And Moses knows he's got to take off.
Yeah.
So he leaves, which is already an interesting thing, because you would think if someone coming out of Pharaoh's house kills an Egyptian soldier, what's the big deal?
Right.
But the very fact that Moses knew that he had to be on the run indicates to us that he knew he was going to be in trouble. He wasn't going to be treated like someone who was coming out of Pharaoh's house. So he goes away. He meets this nice woman, Zipporah. Brings her, you know, at a well. Everything happens at a well. God, you know, finds him and says, "You got to go back. You got to redeem the Jewish people. It's time." He doesn't want to. He, you know, hems and haws. God says, "Enough. Go back. Your brother Aaron will help you." He supposedly had a speech impediment. And they appear before Pharaoh. Pharaoh has none of it. We've got 10 plagues. And finally, Pharaoh says, you know, and each along the way, you see a little give and take. Pharaoh capitulates, says, "Okay, I'll let them go." And then once he sees he's given a little bit, he takes back.
Right.
So, and then you've got them leaving Egypt. Mm. And want me to stop there?
No, you did a wonderful job. I mean, you just covered 4 centuries in just a couple of minutes. That's a feat. So you have... the nation, or maybe we'd say the people of Israel.
But actually, Pharaoh is the first person to refer to them as a nation.
Is he?
Yeah,
that's true.
At the beginning of Exodus.
Yes. Yeah. Okay, so they're considered a nation at this point. And I think probably most listeners are familiar with the story of the Exodus, that they come up out of Egypt. They miraculously go through the waters. And I want us to talk about then. Let's start transitioning to the commemoration of Passover. So one of these plagues, of course, is, and it's kind of the final plague. It is the final plague. Is the death of the firstborn son in every Egyptian home.
Correct.
Let's talk a little bit about that and where we get that term Passover. Is it the same? Does it mean the same in Hebrew, Pesach?
Yep.
Talk a little bit about
Pasach
that.
Means to pass over.
Okay.
So it's literal. It's a great translation. It's a great question, because a lot of times we rely on translations to understand the Hebrew Bible, and along with any translation comes interpretation.
Yes.
So it's that's a good point. But yes, Pesach means to pass over. So it comes out of this idea that the Jews were told to take to paint their doorposts with the blood mm-hmm. of the animal, and by that sign, God would know, or the angel of death would know, to pass over that house.
Yes.
So that's exactly where it comes from.
Okay. And then in Exodus 12, yes. and I'll just read this. God says to Israel, "So this day, Pesach, Passover, shall be to you a memorial, and you shall keep it as a feast to the Lord throughout your generations. You shall keep it as a feast by an everlasting ordinance." And he goes on to instruct the Israelites to eat unleavened bread for 7 days, to remove leaven from the house, to gather together as a people, to commemorate God's deliverance. And as I've read the scriptures, biblically, that commemoration was, as time went on, would be largely centered on the temple once that's constructed and the sacrifices there. Obviously, today there's no temple. Hasn't been since 70 AD or 70 CE. And yet the Jewish community still observes the Passover. Only now it's centered largely on an event known as Seders, Passover Seders. So can you explain what a Seder is, and how did we go from temple to having a meal and observing it with a Seder?
Yeah, absolutely. Or I'll do the best I can.
Sure.
So what you're talking about with regard to the transformation of what the holiday was as it was described biblically and what it became and what it is today is actually not an uncommon theme in Judaism. I think we're the original hoarders, meaning we don't let go of an idea.
Sure.
We just allow it to change and grow or adapt to the times in which we're living. So just like you said, we no longer have a temple. We haven't had one since the second temple was destroyed in 70 CE or 70 AD. And since then, we've had to figure out how do we keep these pieces that we had, which were the sacrifices, as part of our daily lives to remind us, because we don't ever want to forget where we came from. Because once you forget where you come from, you lose the guide of where you're going. Mm. So what's come to replace sacrifice are actually our prayer times. So our prayer times, nighttime, morning, afternoon, are the same times where we offer daily sacrifices.
Yeah.
So we've got the same thing going on here with Passover. We needed to figure out how do we commemorate a holiday that seemed to have had one of its origins around one of its commemoration points. I don't know if that's the right word. Mm-hmm. Around temple sacrifices. So we have what's called a Seder. It's mentioned in a text called the Mishnah. Mm-hmm. So the Mishnah comes after the Hebrew Bible was canonized, after it was closed. It's a set of texts. So the word Mishnah can either be the collection of the books, or it can be the smallest entity in a book. So to like make the Hebrew Bible, it could either, the Mishnah represents the Hebrew Bible. A Mishnah could be a verse in a book,
sure.
in a chapter. That of the sense. Hebrew Bible. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So we've got the Mishnah, and the Mishnah is broken down into tractates, mm-hmm. and each tractate is broken down into chapters. Each chapter is broken down into Mishnahs. Mm. So there's a specific tractate for Passover. It's called Psachim, Passovers.
Yeah.
And it goes through, there are 10 chapters in it, and it goes through the last, the 10th chapter is all about the Seder. So this text called the Mishnah represents the time period from 3rd century BCE or BC to 3rd century CE or 3rd century AD. Mm. It's a long time.
Yeah.
So we as Jews study in layers. We start out with our biblical time period. We move forward, 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 forward. Each more modern layer is basing itself on the previous one and bringing those ideas forward and sometimes having to reinterpret or re-understand them based on where we're sitting today. Mm. That's the way we keep Judaism relevant and lively and as our guide for who we are.
Sure.
So there's a whole tractate in Mishnah, so talking about the Seder, talking about what needs to be part of it, you know, 4 cups of wine, when you make Kiddush, the blessings over the wine, what needs to be said as part of the Seder. So this idea of a Seder already goes back to 3rd century BC, somewhere between 3rd century BCE, CE to 3rd century CE.
Wow. And that's interesting because you know, you read, I've read a variety of scholars and even talked to some rabbis about this, that there's always a question, was the Last Supper that Jesus and his disciples had, was it a Seder? One local rabbi I spoke with, he said, oh, absolutely not. And then I've read others who've said, well, maybe not the way it's observed today, but it could have been some type of a proto-Seder. So maybe that would fit, that might fit culturally, that there was some type of Seder happening at that time.
Of course, there's overlap within the communities.
Right.
I mean, absolutely.
And they were celebrating as Jews at that time,
100%. So yeah. Could it be possible? It absolutely could be possible.
So yeah. would you walk us through a Seder? What is the purpose of the Seder? And maybe some of the key components. I know it, depending on your level of observance, it could be very long or a little bit shorter, but just basically, what are some of the high points of a Seder?
Okay, so I'm going to start out actually before the Seder.
Sure.
So I've already started cooking. Mm. Right? We're on March 22nd.
You've got a while yet.
Yes, I do. But in order for me to start cooking, I have to do what's called kasher my kitchen, mm-hmm. because we need to remove all chametz, all leaven stuff from our kitchens. You can't have any food that mixes with the leaven. Mm. So I've already made my one batch of chicken soup and one batch of matzo balls. So I koshered my sink, my countertops, my stovetop, brought up. I have different dishes, different pots, different, I have to use new sponges. Mm. So mm-hmm. I already did that once. I'll be doing it again on Sunday
okay.
or on Monday. I'm going to be making another batch of chicken soup.
Making me hungry, Rabbi.
More than welcome to come, Ty. So that has to happen, and then you know you need a separation between the leaven and the unleavened materials. Mm-hmm.
Can I ask about that?
Yeah,
just
please,
for a
anything.
Moment. In the New Testament context, yeah. leaven is always associated with sin.
Right.
Is that the same in Judaism?
It's not.
Okay.
Sometimes in Judaism, we are told what to do, but we're not given the reason why. So we have mitzvot, commandments, and there are many different ways you can explain the commandments or divide them into groups. One of them is called mishpatim as one group, and one is called chukim as another group. That's just one way. So the mishpatim are mitzvot that we understand just when we hear them.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
They're common sense.
Common sense mitzvot.
Yeah.
Chukim are mitzvot that we have not necessarily, right? Mixing wool and linen.
Right.
We're not allowed to mix wool and linen in a garment. We're not told why.
You do it because
do
God
it.
Says it.
Because God says it. Do it, and yeah. that's what we do. And the rabbis later on, remember I said we work in layers.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we also see, I also mentioned, we have, if there are words that we don't understand, that's actually an open door, an invitation to come on in and interpret.
Mm.
And that's what the rabbis do in later generations.
Sure.
And that's what we do today. Right?
Right.
We interpret, we go back, we put our spin in a positive way on words. Like in this room on Mondays, we have a staff meeting. Every staff meeting starts out with a Dvar Torah. One of our staff gives a Dvar Torah. They bring us the summary of the Torah portion, and then they bring a piece, they highlight a piece that meant something to them and talk about it through the lens of how they understand it today.
Mm-hmm.
Leaven. Okay, so leaven, you also have to remember many of our holidays, especially Passover, Sukkot, and Shavuot, have agricultural connections
sure.
to them.
Right.
So Passover also has an agricultural piece to it. The leaven was thought of as possible. We're not really told why no leaven. Later on, people do go and use this idea that because leaven expands pieces, we need to be careful of being too haughty, that it's reminding us not necessarily of sin,
mm-hmm.
but that we need to be thoughtful about who we are
okay.
and how we're behaving in the world.
Yeah. So you remove the chametz.
Yep.
And you're looking, so you're, as you said, you're preparing food even
yep.
now. What's the process of, is a Passover Seder, are you inviting just family? Are you inviting friends? What does that look like?
Passover Seder, I think, is one of the biggest holidays or meals that Jews around the world, even the most secular, celebrate in whatever form it is. Mm-hmm. And there is what's called a Haggadah, right, which is the book that we use.
Kind of a liturgy? Would that be what you'd call that?
Absolutely, you could call it a liturgy. It also, you know, has biblical verses in it. It has commentary on the biblical verses in it, and has songs in it, and has commemorative actions in it. The Seder itself is the meal that you sit down to using the Haggadah to tell the story of the Exodus. Using, we use props. It's a great educational tool.
Yeah.
Right? Storytelling, not only in Judaism, I think in most cultures, is an essential piece to transmitting the values, the commandments, the uniqueness, the everything of who you are to the next generation.
And it's multi-sensory,
Multi-sensory.
That's what I always found so interesting. When I went to, our mutual friend, Rabbi Felipe Goodman, I went to a Seder at his home, and they had, you know, decorations and things like that, and then you're eating, so you're feeling texture and your taste and your smelling, and all of that unites with the text of the, with the Haggadah, and so you are learning from multiple directions, and I think
you're reading
really
through,
cool.
And you're tasting whatever it is, the maror, which represents the bitterness. It's bitter, and you're eating that at the same time that you're talking about it. So exactly what you're saying. So you can get the feeling through all senses. As you're reading through the text, you bring it to life. People do plays. People do. If you're one who uses electricity on the holidays, we do not use electricity on the holidays, but I've known people who do multimedia storytelling. Our kids used to put on little plays telling, you know, what they, you know, one was Moses, one was Aaron, one was, you know, one was Pharaoh. You've Bed Bath and Beyond, God love them, right? You can go online and find Passover kits. We would take chocolate bars and break them into little pieces and have our kids build pyramids. It's all about making it welcoming for the kids and getting them to ask questions.
Sure.
So we can then have responses to the question. Oh, what a great question you asked. Here's the story. We need to tell the story of Passover so that they understand where they came from and that they're a part of this story. It wasn't that we're reading it and it happened to someone else. We have an obligation to make sure that we here in 2024 feel as if we were coming out of Egypt.
And you even have four questions built right into the Haggadah.
Correct.
So that there's at least four that are going to be asked. And those are, correct me if I'm wrong, they're to be asked by a child or
correct.
Children, and then the leader of the Seder responds by essentially answering the questions, teaching them more about what happened
correct.
During the
correct. The and you're supposed to put things on the table that's going to get the kids to ask questions so that we can then give the answer. Because again, it's all about the next generation. It's all about bringing them in, letting them realize there's something weird going on here. Why are we doing this today? Whether it's dipping or it's reclining right. or it's whatever it is, you know, whatever it is, what's this matzah that we have on the table? Where's the bread? Whatever it is, it's getting them to ask questions so then we can provide answers. And there's not one, there's never one answer. There's always one answer to jump off to. But I have on my shelf, and this is not uncommon, this is very common, 50 different Haggadahs. Right, different commentaries coming from different people written. So the text itself is all the same.
Sure.
Meaning the text of the Haggadah, the text of the storytelling is all the same. But down below at the bottom of the page, you're going to have commentary. And whoever you're picking, that's who's commentary. So we never use, a lot of people have the same Haggadah, and everybody, you know, you kind of go around the table, and people, and some houses, this is how we do it in ours, people go around the table and read different parts of it. Some parts are done by the Seder leader, which is usually the father of the household. It could be the mother of the household, whoever, one of the adults of the household.
Okay.
It's usually given to the, you know, it's an honor.
Right.
So it's usually given to a grandparent, or does it make sense?
Yeah.
The four questions are usually asked by the youngest in the family, and then you've got it being led by the oldest. But we never have the same Haggadah. What we do in our house is we send out a sheet. Sign up for who's giving a Dvar Torah about which piece of the Seder, because we never want it to get old.
Sure.
But we never have the same Haggadah on the table.
That's interesting.
So that way someone who might be reading their Haggadah might pop up and say, wait a second, I have something interesting to add here. Perfect. So you've got a script, but the script is the jumping off point.
Yeah.
Never the end point.
Mm. So the elements, that's what we want to call them, of the plate itself. Oh, so you have the Seder plate,
right.
And you have, I guess we'll call them elements, different foods. They're not necessarily meant to fill you up at that point. They're part of the story. What are those elements? And if you can just briefly say, what does each one represent in the telling of the story?
Good. So we've got matzah, mm-hmm. obviously. So matzah is the unleavened bread that we are obligated to use, that we have an obligation to actually eat on the first night of Passover. Mm. So in the diaspora, which is where we are, mm-hmm. outside the land of Israel, we have two holiday days of Passover, the beginning. Then we have an intermediary days. And then we have two holiday days at the end. Mm. So what that means is in the two holiday days at the beginning and the two holiday days at the end, those of us who do not use electricity, do not drive, we follow those same rules on both those bookend days.
Okay.
The intermediary days, we're permitted to use electricity. Some people choose to go to work. Some people say, I'm not going to work because it's kind of holiday, kind of weekday.
Okay.
Prayers are different. Prayers are a mixture of the holiday and the weekday. But you know, we're allowed to use electricity. We're permitted to write. We're permitted to go on our phones. We're mm-hmm. permitted to watch TV. In Israel, it's one day at each end.
Okay.
You with me?
Yes.
Okay. So we have the matzahs. So we've got three matzahs. Two matzahs are there because that's how we have two challahs for Shabbat,
mm-hmm.
right? Because the manna came down on Friday, we got two pieces.
For those listeners who don't know challah, it's like the best bread in the world, this braided bread. So that's challah, but then this is the unleavened bread, so it's the matzah.
Matzah, not quite as good as
the challah. No, not at all.
And then we've got a third piece in there. Some people, and that's to represent the obligation that we have to eat matzah. So we have an obligation to eat matzah on the first night of Passover. Mm-hmm. I don't have to eat matzah again for the rest of the week or any other time during the year.
Okay.
But I have to eat it. I have to have a certain amount in order to fulfill my obligation of eating matzah. Some people say that the three matzahs represent the three different groupings of Jews, which is the Kohanim, the Levites, and the Israelites.
Mm-hmm.
So here you can already see
this interpretation.
Exactly. Yes. We then have the zroa or the shank bone, and that's for representative of the paschal offering, mm-hmm. right? As you stated, we no longer have offerings, but God forbid we forget something. We have it right there on the plate to remind us that we had one of these offerings.
Sure.
And it represents the idea that God, because it says in there that God redeemed us with an outstretched arm.
Yes.
So
the strength.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. We then have the egg. The roasted egg reminds us of one of the other sacrificial offerings, the chagiga. Mm-hmm. And it also represents spring and a birth. Mm-hmm. So we have that on the plate. We then have maror, which is the bitter herbs, and that obviously represents the bitterness of the slavery.
And that's usually often a horseradish, right?
So it's horseradish. It's also been you know, some people use lettuce,
okay.
like romaine lettuce.
Now, can I ask you about that?
Please.
Because I've seen, you know, if you get a Seder plate, a lot of times it has a depiction of what you put in each one. And so
the word and then a picture.
Yes, yes. And if it's in Hebrew, I have to go by the picture. But often you'll see what appears to be a representation of horseradish right. and of lettuce.
Right.
Is that just because you get to choose which one you want, or is there some play in that?
I from what I understand is that people have them both on, they have it both on the plate because both can be used for the same piece. Does that make sense?
Sure.
And then the last thing we have, we have two more pieces. One is charoset, and that's the mixture of fruit and mm-hmm. nuts, and the maror is kind of dipped, and that's kind of sweet.
Right.
So that we don't have a specific blessing for because it's not an obligation, okay. but it's in that Mishnah that talks about in the 10th chapter of the Tractate of Pesachim that says we eat that.
Okay.
So some people make an association between there's a verse in the Song of Songs, under the apple tree I awakened you, which the rabbis say applies to God
mm-hmm.
and the Israelites leading them to redemption. So we bring in anything that has to do with apples
sure.
and stuff like that. Do you have a question about that?
Not about that. Okay. There's an element that I've been at. I was at a synagogue or at a Seder put on by a more liberal Jewish woman, and she had an orange on the plate,
yep.
and she explained that to me. But why, if someone is invited to a Seder and they see an orange, Where does that come from?
So the my understanding of the orange has to do with women's liberation,
right?
And this idea of, you know, we're going to have women's, you know, women rabbis or women's liberation when an orange makes it to the Seder plate.
Okay.
So women started putting oranges on Seder plates to say, okay, we're here. You see, this is where we have again the layers in Judaism. We create opportunities to bring things to the table, literally and figuratively, mm-hmm. to the table that are happening in our lives right now that could fit into this idea. Mm-hmm. So my gut is unfortunately, if there are still hostages being held by Hamas, you're going to see things going out through social media, email, etc., saying this year we are doing this,
sure.
at our seders to remind ourselves that there are people who still need to be redeemed.
Yeah. So you see at Shabbat, some Shabbat dinners, people are leaving a seat exactly. open for in commemoration of the yep. hostages who are not there. And maybe I could tie this in. Please. Because there's an empty chair at a Seder.
Correct.
And this has nothing to do with the hostages. But what is that chair about?
You're talking about for Elijah?
Elijah's chair. Yes,
yes. We're waiting for Elijah to come, right? Elijah's mm-hmm. going to come and bring about, he's going to be the person who's going to announce the beginning of the Messianic era. Mm-hmm. Elijah visits everybody's house. We actually have a cup that we have in there. We have, so not only four cups of wine, there's a fifth cup that's Elijah's cup, and it stays there, and you leave it there overnight with the hope that Elijah is going to come, and with that we're going to have the announcement of the Messianic era.
Yeah.
Wait, we got two more pieces.
I'm sorry, I interrupted you with the orange question there.
It was a good question, but you also had pieces with Soviet Jewry when we were trying to get Soviet Jews out of the Soviet Union. Mm. People were putting other pieces on their Seder plates to remind themselves of that.
Sure.
In terms of Shabbat, people are lighting extra Shabbat candles for the hostages that are being held by Hamas. So we have all these places where we look at and we say our rituals are beginnings but never ends.
Sure.
Okay, so we have karpas, which is the vegetable which is dipped in, which is going to be our last piece, the salt water, and that is usually celery, although some people use other pieces as well, and that's the tears, the bitterness, etc. So this Seder plate sits on the table. We don't use it other than decorative, but we use the pieces around it, meaning we don't, in our house, we have whatever on the Seder plate, aside from the shank bone, but just ever on the Seder plate, we have little plates of to be passed around to each individual who's attending the
so
Seder.
So you're not passing the Seder plate. You have it at your
because
own
you have place. To remember, at the time in which the Seder was created, they didn't eat at dining room tables. They ate at their own little tables. It was like TV dinners.
Yeah.
So they had little tables that were put in front of them. So everybody had their own place. You do have places where, and it'll be interesting to see what two of my sons just got married this year. So it'll be interesting to see what they do this year. If they have their own, if they want their own individual Seder plate in front of them to represent their own family.
Okay.
Does that make sense? Sometimes yeah. you'll have that. You'll have each, sometimes people will do males, all males. Some people will do, everyone has their own Seder plate in front of them. So in that case, they could be eating off of their Seder plate, but usually you're passing stuff around.
Okay.
And it's an intro, but that's not the whole meal.
Yeah.
Because just like you said, it's not going to fill you up.
Sure. I want to ask you this just in closing.
We're done already?
I know. You've
got so much time. There's so many things to talk about.
Well, you mentioned this. This is going to be a different kind of Passover.
Correct.
In light of October 7th. I want to ask you, not only in light of October 7th, but just living in the 21st century, for you personally, what does Passover mean to you? What is the significance of it? You were talking about how there's commentary throughout. And you said in a positive way, there's spin on it. What's the spin you put on it personally? What's the significance to you?
I think this year there's a spin on the personal level. My mother, who lives in Israel, said she wants to come to us for Passover this year. We were hoping to go there, but she wanted to come here. We said, okay, kibud avam, honoring your parents. Mm-hmm. You do what your mom says. So my mom's coming. My brother's coming from Israel. All three of my sons and and two of them who've gotten married, and their wives are all coming to our house for Passover too. So that's going to be really very, very exciting in terms of the family getting together. It really sure. is about this, you know, one of those pieces of family being together and spending time and the commentary that goes back and forth. For me, this year, it really is with regard to October 7th. It's been a tremendously difficult year.
Yeah.
And the idea of redemption from slavery, I think, has new meaning because we've got, unfortunately, we've got 134?
Or so is last I heard.
Right. God willing, some of them are alive. Mm-hmm. We've been waiting for them to come home. Here's an opportunity for Jews around the world to come together on the same night, reading the same texts, pleading to God in saying, you know, please, God, help us. Help the Israeli army bring them home.
Yeah.
It can also be a very uplifting time, right? Knowing strength in numbers, knowing that as much anti-Semitism as there is around, and it's, you know, quadrupled since October 7th, that we Jews aren't going anywhere.
Right.
We're not losing who we are. We need to be stronger in terms of who we are, not weaker. We don't need to hide in the corner. We need to come out wearing whatever our Jewish garb is or whatever our Jewish associations are. We need to come out stronger with those, even more so this year because of what's been happening around us.
Mm. You end each Seder with a saying, and I love it. That is, at least in English, next year in Jerusalem. There are now more Jewish people living in Israel than throughout the diaspora. And so to some extent, that has been, that expectation, that dream has been met. What does that mean for Jewish people in the diaspora today? Does it mean literally we want to celebrate Passover in Jerusalem, or is there another symbolic meaning to that for a lot of Jewish people?
Because you're asking me an either-or question, Ty, which you should know. We don't do either-or.
This is true.
We do ands.
Yes.
So this idea, you have to remember when a lot of these things, a lot of these traditions took place. So from the year 70 CE, 70 AD, until 1949, there was no state of Israel, right? 1948, we had the war, 1949. So we have reestablishment of the state of Israel. But during that time, those thousands of years, it was a dream for us to be able to live in the land of Israel as an autonomous nation going by our commandments. Our commandments cover not only the ritual, but how we work the land, mm-hmm. right? There are agricultural commandments that you can't do outside of the land of Israel.
Right.
So this idea of L'shana haba'ab Yerushalayim, some people add on habnuya, right? The rebuilt, the complete, this idea, I think it's multifaceted. Just like, we're going back to the beginning, just like in that piece of in Genesis, toward the end of Genesis, we got the feeling based on the words that are used, it talks about the Israelites, vayachozu, that they held on, they gripped on to the land when they went down with Joseph. That wasn't supposed to happen.
Right.
So is the diaspora a temporary peace? Is the diaspora a permanent peace for somebody? It's a very good question. You're hitting at a big debate that people have been having for many, many years in terms of where should Jews be located. We've all had the option of picking up and going back since 1948.
Right.
Many of us have chosen to stay here. We need to figure out why we've chosen to stay here. And what does that mean about our connection with Israel? For some Jews, unfortunately, it's a place to visit. For other Jews, it's part of our identity.
Well, Rabbi, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk with me and for taking us not only on a four-century overview of Israel's history, but really the last 3,000 years or so, looking at Passover and the significance. And so I want to thank you for that, and I wish you a happy Passover.
Thank you, Ty. Happy Passover to you, too.
You've been listening to Gesher, a ministry outreach production of FOI Equip, your free resource for learning and engaging with the scriptures from a Jewish perspective. To learn more, visit foiequip.org. And for more information about Ty, visit foi.org/Perry. Until next time, may the Lord bless you and keep you. Shalom.